Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Freedom Report. I'm here today with a very special guest, a regular here, Jack Hunter. Jack, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be with you.
And Ian Hewitt, welcome back, my associate editor.
Always a pleasure.
All right, guys, so today we're going to get right into it, and Rand Paul is under attack. The neocons are dive-bombing him from every angle. If you read the Washington Post like me every morning, you'll always see some sort of hate-filled article about how Rand Paul sucks by Jennifer Rubin. But it seems like now everybody's dog-piling on top of him. You got Brett Stevens, we got Rich Lowry joining Jennifer Rubin. Everybody is attacking Rand Paul over his foreign policy, but he doesn't really have a whole congealed foreign policy yet. He hasn't been the president yet. I think these people sound like they're just terrified of what he might do, but nobody really knows what he might do. Why are all these people attacking him, Jack?
I think terrified is the operative word there. So, you know, the Republican Party, it's always whatever its last model was. So Bush-Cheney was that model, and there was a lot of people invested in the idea of an aggressive foreign policy. Some of them I would call neoconservatives. Some of them I would just call hawks, who aren't necessarily that. But anyways, they're invested ideologically in the idea that America should police the world and we should do a lot militarily all over the world. So along comes a Rand Paul, who's popular with the Tea Party and in the conservative base. He's also growing the party in almost every way the Republican establishment thinks the party needs to be grown, whether that's among youth, whether that's among minorities, whether it's reaching independents. He's doing all these things. So the one guy who's doing the thing that virtually everybody in the party agrees needs to happen is also very opposite from where the neoconservatives and the hawks are on this primary issue of foreign policy, primary to them. That terrifies them. That's exactly what's happening right now. So what you're seeing every day with Jennifer Rubin, who, you know, writes like a fourth grader half the time, and people who are much better writers and thinkers, I think, like Brett Stevens and Rich Lowry, who is not reflexively anti-Rand Paul in any sort of way, they're trying to marginalize him. It's about, you know, he said in 2009 that we went to war in Iraq because of Halliburton. He went on Alex Jones' show one time. He had a crazy aide that used to do things. You know, they bring me up. They're trying to marginalize him the best they can because they can't not meet him on the foreign policy arguments themselves. Are they going to say, most Americans wanted us to be in Syria? Well, most Americans didn't, including Republicans. Most Americans wanted us to be in Libya. Well, no, that wasn't true either. If you look at the polling on Iran, are they worried about a nuclear Iran? They are, but they prefer diplomacy to military action 2-1 in almost every poll you see. Ukraine, most Americans don't like what's going on over there, but they don't want the U.S. involved militarily. Across the board, more Americans, and I dare say more and more Republicans are with Rand Paul than that old Bush-Cheney, Jennifer Rubin, Brett Stevens, neoconservative, hawkish model. That's not where the American people are, and less Republicans than ever. That's what scares the hell out of them about Rand Paul. He has that groundswell of public support behind him, and he's doing everything right. Some missteps here and there, some mistakes, but doing everything virtually every Republican thinks their party needs to do. He is the leader, in many respects. That scares the hell out of people who are, more than anything, committed to an aggressive foreign policy.
Okay, now, hold on. I want you to respond to that, yeah, but ahead. I want to put you on the spot here, Ian. Now, the reason I hired you is because you are a brilliant young man. Now, I'm going to put you're my associate editor, and I trust your opinion on things.
All right, let me have it.
Now, here's the thing. You were getting ready to respond to Jack Hunter's thing. Jack did say that there were some missteps. And one of the things that you and I pride ourselves on is our objectivity. Now, some of the missteps that Rand Paul made that these neocons are taking him to task for were his statements about Cheney possibly deciding to invade Iraq because it might burnish his bottom line. Of Halliburton. Now, I did some research on that, and I found out that that wasn't true. So, looking at something like that, do you think that that gives the neocons more power over him? Do you think that he's got to be more careful about things like that in the future?
You're right, it wasn't true. I don't think that Rand Paul was saying, though, that Cheney, for personal profit, made the decision to go to war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think he was saying he used to be the CEO of Halliburton, he's got all these connections, and he has that perspective. And so, of course, he is going to be thinking, in some sense about Halliburton's interest when he's making decisions as vice president. That's just inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So to respond to what Jack just said, he's absolutely right that the party establishment is focused on the last presidency. And that's so ironic for the Republican Party because conservatism is supposed to be about long-standing tradition and about moral order that doesn't change from one presidential cycle to the next.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have, you know, Ronald Reagan's own son saying that Rand Paul is right and he gets his dad's policies. We have, in Rand Paul's latest op-ed in National Review, direct quotes from Bill Buckley supporting Rand Paul's perspective on foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
And you still have Rich Lowry with his blinders on thinking that somehow I right now understand conservatism better than all these other people.
Well, there's
better than the actual tradition.
Well, there's a strand of progressivism in the Republican Party, Jack. These are people who do want to change from generation to generation, and they may not have progressive policies when it comes to social issues, but they have the progressives' issues when it comes to war, and that is what Bill Buckley called Wilsonianism.
Yes.
And, you know, Woodrow Wilson being that progressive hero, I think that Ian makes a good point when he talks about conservatism is really about having longstanding traditions that are right no matter what, but there's been a warping of these views. And what do you say to that?
Right, and I believe Buckley, in his exchange with George Will, you know, he just made the point that, you know, Republicans' foreign policy views under Bush Cheney, how we approached the Iraq War, was Wilsonian, what some would term progressive. It was the idea that we could change societies that have never had a Bill of Rights or a Constitution or anything like our form of government into something that looks a little bit more like our form of government. That is very utopian thinking. That is what the neoconservatives believe and still believe. They think it's America's role to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most Americans are there, and I think more conservatives than ever are going, what happened to this limited government stuff we used to believe in? You know, Bush grew the government like any bigger than any president before Obama. We need to get back to that. And I remember during the Bush-Cheney era, and even after that, you know, people like Rick Santorum and other Republicans would say that it's good that the Republicans are getting away from this Reagan-Goldwater idea that government needs to be smaller. It doesn't need to be smaller. It just needs to be more streamlined, or however they put it. Most conservatives have never believed that. And that conversation that virtually all conservatives want, you know, smaller government, take less of our taxes, much, much less spending, ties in with the foreign policy stuff. You can't spend trillions of dollars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and then be as upset from a moral standpoint about spending trillions on something like Obamacare.
Right.
They're both cost trillions of dollars, and they're both not worth doing, quite frankly. And I think more people than ever are open to that message.
But you were talking about the average voter, and you're probably right that the average voter just doesn't want to be involved in policing the world and spreading democracy on the world. They don't want to be attacked. The average voter probably does tend to worry about Iran getting a nuke, however. I think that that's probably something that would scare anybody, just because you don't, you know, who wants to have a theocratic regime in charge of a nuclear weapon? Now, you've got Pakistan has already got it, and there are a bunch of crazy theocrats that run around in that country as well with nuclear weapons. But again, the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons has sort of balanced power against their neighbor India. And so actually you would say that possibly security has been stabilized in that region because of the fact that they both had nuclear weapons. So Rand Paul sort of gets slapped around because he's talked about a policy of containment with Iran, but he also echoed Ronald Reagan's foreign policy that we shouldn't broadcast our policy
right before
we have our policy. What
right.
do you say about that?
I loved his point. If we had decided before Pakistan got nukes, we're going to use any and all means to prevent Pakistan from getting nukes, we would have had a needless war with Pakistan, and I say needless because we're not at war with Pakistan right now.
Mm-hmm.
Pakistan
right.
has not attacked us. I think national security is often really a pretext for the neocons. Their motives are ultimately, if you look at what they say and what their thinkers say, utopian, to use the word Jack just used.
Mm-hmm.
And conservatism comes from Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke said, people have limitations, and no matter how much power you give a central government, it can't engineer an earthly utopia for us.
Mm-hmm.
But neocons think they can engineer a utopia everywhere, all over the world, and that's an enormous divergence from the conservative intellectual tradition.
I think that all of this says...
he spelled it out perfectly.
High five. Go ahead, Jack. Do you want to respond to that?
No, that's exactly right. I just had to high five Ian.
That was a nice high five.
I just high five Jack Hunter.
Okay, so here's the deal, ladies and gentlemen. The neocons are terrified. And I think one of the reasons why they are so terrified is because they don't have any good, strong, clear leadership like they used to. I mean,
these ideas don't make any damn sense. They never did.
Yeah, well, but here's the thing. They're trying to coalesce and they're trying to coagulate their support behind what they can see as a strong leader in 2016. And here's what they got. They got Chris Christie, who nobody likes. They've got John Bolton, who raised $2 million for his PAC, and which is just that got me gobsmacked. And then they got Jeb Bush. And the thing with Jeb Bush is, they did a poll recently, showed only 18% of conservatives want him to run. 43% of them don't want him to run. His own mom doesn't want him to run. His own mother, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't want Jeb Bush to run. I think the neocons are kind of like, over here, okay, no, this guy, we got that guy. And like, whereas the Tea Party, we sort of know who are our guys. You know, like, right. We're sort of on the, we're on the strong end of this battle, right now. Even though they're raising money, the establishment always sort of has like that guaranteed cash, you know, that's going to infuse their pocketbooks. The heart, the spirit, the ideology, the voters, the hearts and minds seem to be on our side. Don't you agree?
Well, right. And the hawks and many of the neoconservatives are so single issue that they will turn on a dime on a candidate if they think that candidate is suddenly more pro-war than somebody else. Mm-hmm. Let's look at Jennifer Rubin's ongoing relationship with Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. So a few months ago when the defund strategy Obamacare was going on, there was not a worse person in Jennifer Rubin's universe than Ted Cruz.
Right.
He was destroying the Republican Party. The Tea Party is what's wrong with the Republican Party. These extremists, you know, groups like Freedom Works, the Campaign for Liberty, and they're awful, awful, awful. So you get the situation with Iran. There's a dispute or spat between Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, and, you know, Cruz exhibits what some would say a more hawkish or aggressive foreign policy than maybe Senator Paul did, and all of a sudden, Jennifer Rubin starts to talk very favorably about Ted Cruz.
Right.
All of a sudden, you can see that this week. Just go read it. And why? Mm-hmm. Because she thinks he might be more willing to give her the war she wants and that mm-hmm. kind of foreign policy mm-hmm. than a Rand Paul. That is their single issue. You can see it. It's so transparent.
You know what it is, Jack, is Jennifer Rubin is an incrementalist. And in the libertarian movement, we have this term where we say, you know, if you're an incrementalist, I'll support anyone who wants to make the government just a little bit smaller. Yeah. And then I'll support someone who wants to make it smaller than that, and so on. Rubin will just support whoever wants to make it even just a little bit bigger. She's an incrementalist on bigger government.
I don't get it.
If Ted Cruz is a bit bigger than Rand Paul, then she'll support him.
Yeah, I hate to, you know, use hyperbole and pejoratives, but I mean, it's like, how much blood does she drink at night? Does she require from the children of the Middle East? You know, I think that the issue is they don't want Rand Paul to be associated with the legacy of Reagan, even though he may embody the Reaganite policy much more than they do. They're twisting it. They're twisting his foreign policy, and they're twisting his words. Reagan was not a warmonger, you know, like they are.
No, he wasn't.
No, and I think that the problem here is that they are warmongers, and they're very good at using the strategies of progressives to try and to change the rhetoric so that it seems as if, you know, everybody was supporting them all along, when in reality, these neocons are Trotskyites, they are progressives, and they have way more in common than the left than they do with real conservatives.
Well, that's true, and I would say, you know, look, I disagree with these people on foreign policy and on civil liberties issues, where they sort of act like the Fourth Amendment doesn't exist. I think a lot of them, though, you know, are working off a premise that they think these things are actually good for the country. I don't think they're inherently evil people or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We just have a difference of opinion, and I like to avoid as much as possible making about the personalities involved. Let's talk about the issues. The problem they have right now is if they talk about the issues, they're going to lose. Mm-hmm. Their issues are discredited. Mm-hmm. Their ideas are discredited. So what do they make it about? Oh, well, Rand Paul said something crazy in 2009. Mm-hmm. That's where they are, and that's where they need to keep things if they have any hope. And, like, you know, Senator Paul and, you know, people like they don't see him as crazy or out of the mainstream, no matter how hard his Republican enemies try, and increasingly his liberal enemies who see him as a threat to a Hillary Clinton or somebody like that.
Yeah, I want to talk about the most dangerous topic for libertarians to discuss when it comes to this issue, Ian. I want you to start to talk about this, because the most dangerous topic in the world for libertarians is going to be in 2016 if Rand Paul wins. I think there are a lot of libertarians who don't want Rand Paul to win for one reason. Because he would be required to build a government. And in so doing, he would have to actually build a foreign policy, a realist foreign policy. And some of that may mean a departure from some of libertarians' more hardcore precepts of non-intervention. There may be times when Rand, if he were to win, would be placed in a situation where, you know, there may be a confrontation with Iran. And so I guess the question here is, Ian, is how do we parse our beliefs that we want to, I mean, impose, I wouldn't say impose, but that we want the American people to accept, with the reality that if Rand Paul were to win, we would have to build a government, and in some ways that would go against our principles.
You know, I actually don't think it'd be as challenging as it sounds, mm-hmm. because, and Rand Paul has been great on this already, our government wastes so much money on so many ridiculous things that you can always do what Rand Paul does, which is introduce a measure to fund something using offsets to other areas. So Rand Paul will say, okay, I'll introduce this bill to fund, you know, highways and the infrastructure, but that expense will be more than offset by cuts in the same bill to foreign aid.
Mm-hmm.
So since we have such a bloated and gigantic government, you can always do that. And we just talked about incrementalism. If you're an incrementalist who wants to increase liberty, you can always simply support the measure that's going to decrease the scope of government.
Mm-hmm.
We can really run an effective government by incrementalism, by cutting these other wasteful areas.
But here's the problem, Jack. The president is not a dictator. And I think that a lot of people, the utopians in the libertarian world, tend to look at it and like, well, if only the right guy was elected, our guy was elected, he would do it. Even if Ron Paul had been elected, he would not have been able to abolish the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Right.
Ron Paul would have been in the awkward position of having to appoint someone to the head of the ATF. Now, what is that going to do to us?
Right. I think, you know, I believe, you call it trickle-down politics, whatever you want to call it. If Rand Paul or Ron Paul or Justin Amash, if any of these guys were president, it wouldn't change the world overnight. Would it make a difference? Yeah, it would make a pretty significant difference, but it wouldn't change everything. You still have a Senate to deal with. You still have a House to deal with. You still have an American populace that doesn't care about all this libertarian, liberal, conservative stuff. They just want what's right for the country, and rightly so. But what you would have is, you know, we do have two major parties in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican Party stands for A, B, and C, and the Democratic Party stands for A, B, and C. Somebody like Rand Paul is better on some of the Democrat issues than most Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
He's certainly better than most Republicans on spending and size of government issues. You could make the Republican Party more the Rand Paul Party, as it once was Reagan's party.
Mm-hmm.
It could become that. He could become the standard bearer. And that does have an impact on American politics. And if somebody, whether it's him becomes president or a successor or down the road, you're reshaping American politics. To our libertarian friends, I would say, there's a big difference between wanting to maintain the political integrity of your own identity
mm-hmm.
and wanting to transform the country. Those are two very different things. And I'm not saying that either one's not worth it. I, for one, I'm more interested in seeing a more libertarian America than I am in a libertarian utopia. I don't expect to ever see the second, but the first, I would say not only can I expect to see it, but we're already starting to see glimmers of hope.
Austin, I also have to point out Ronald Reagan had to appoint someone to be the head of the Office of Personnel Management, and he appointed Donald Devine, who sacked 100,000 right. government employees. So you can appoint useful people to these positions. Now, we should regardless be wary of a strong executive, even if that executive is reducing the scope of government. Because if we set that precedent, the next person who gets in there, it's going to be that much easier for them to expand the scope of government.
Yeah, why couldn't a libertarian president issue a lot of awesome executive orders towards liberty and then get rid of executive orders altogether?
Exactly.
Well, and here's I'll tell you why not. I'll tell you why not. And here's my playing the devil's advocate on that is because when we're talking about strategies for liberty, one of the best examples that I like to look towards, if you guys haven't read it, and maybe you guys who are listening haven't read it, you should definitely read Mark Twain's book. It was called A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And in Mark Twain's book, he basically is putting together the strategy for liberty. Because what happens is that a Connecticut Yankee from the 1920s ends up in King Arthur's Court, and he finds a population of people who are very credulous. They believe in anything. They believe in magic. And so he tricks the population into believing that he's a wizard by using just standard, modern technology. He creates bombs and things like that. And so people tend to imbue him with this power that they believe he is a very powerful wizard, which he sort of eggs on. And in so doing, he starts to try to introduce the concepts of modern liberty to a population that has no concept of liberty whatsoever. And so the book itself, it ends, unfortunately, without any real conclusion as to how to bring liberty to a population of people who aren't ready for it yet. So what I worry about is that the strategy for liberty is that some people might say, well, we can just impose it by fiat. But if the people aren't ready for it, is that really the way to go? And the reason I say that is, for a good example, is when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, he signed a bill that legalized abortion, even though he was against it. And why did he do that? He did it because he thought that that was what the people wanted, the will of the people. And my question is that I have to ask myself, Jack, and this is just philosophical ranting here, but I mean, if people don't want liberty, if people aren't ready for it yet, how far should we go in forcing them on it? You know, Murray Rothbard said, well, if there was a button that I could hit that would just totally destroy the government today, mm-hmm. I would hit that button and I would destroy it, and then I would yank that carpet out from under everybody's feet. So, and I mean, you just sort of expressed something similar to that by saying, well, let's just push all these executive orders and we'll free the country by force. But isn't that what the neocons are trying to do? They're trying to free everybody by force?
Well, I would start by saying there's not an easy answer to what you're saying, but we do know what the answer is not, and that's central planning. So on a plethora of questions, I would say that the answers aren't in Washington. They're not with everybody sending their tax dollars to Washington, D.C. Let's minimize that as much as possible. Let states and locales and municipalities deal with as much as possible. Obviously, that doesn't work on things like national security and whatnot, but different discussions need to be had there as well. You can't central plan the world from the Pentagon either. We've learned that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the key to all these things. What a lot of libertarians are going to have to understand is that the real world doesn't line up with anybody's ideology completely. I think libertarianism is the best ideology on the ideological market, period, bar none. Libertarian conservatism, particularly. I think conservatism, you know, would be a close second. Liberalism, I think, has been god-awful. Progressivism. But, you know, you could go down the list. Yeah. But any of these are not going to be perfectly applied in real-world terms. Mm-hmm. And if you can come to grips with that, that's just, we're human beings. That's mm-hmm. just how the world is. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, we can fight for some very important things, some big policy changes, some things that can really transform the country and make a real difference in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. What are you saying?
I think we should increase liberty by whatever means happen to become available to us. And you're right that there is a certain sort of culture that is most conducive to liberty, but we can't wait until we've promoted that culture everywhere. If we decentralized power tomorrow, then some areas would make bad decisions and some would make good ones. Mm-hmm. But that's inevitable because people are people and we're going to do what we like. We should create the opportunity for the good areas to make the good decisions. Leave the opportunity open to people. I think that's what liberty is about, and not attaining perfect results everywhere.
Economic freedom and personal liberty every single day here at the Libertarian Republic podcast. I just want to say thank you very much to Jack Hunter for joining us on the show today. As always, Ian Hewitt, thank you very much for coming on the show. And if you enjoy us, please do us a favor. Go to iTunes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you really like us, give us your email address. And this month, if you send your email, you'll be entered to win a replica of George Washington's flintlock pistol. It's our first president's beautiful gun that he carried during the Revolutionary War. So send us your email and you'll be entered to win a replica of George Washington's firearm. And as always, come back every single day to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at the Libertarian Republic.com.